Everyone, good morning, good afternoon. How are you? My name is Dave Keller. I'm the chief market strategist at StockCharts.com. We're based in the Pacific Northwest outside of Redmond, Washington. Pleasure to be with all of you virtually. I'm super thrilled to be included in the Tech Wizards 2021 conference and appreciate the invite from David and Anka for sure. My presentation, what I wanted to share with you is what I call 7 bull market mistakes and how to avoid them. So most of my work at Stock Charts and with my own firm, which I sort of broadly call market misbehavior, is focused on investor decision making. And what I've learned over my career in the financial industry is that unfortunately for all of us, we are hardwired to make fairly poor decisions about our finances, about our investments. And that's not just if you're just getting started. And we've seen certainly an influx of, you know, new inexperienced investors learning some challenging lessons about what happens in market upswings and then market downswings and bubble phases when they bubbles expand and when they pop or they recede. But even seasoned investors, I've worked with, you know, money managers running billion, you know, 10, 20, $100 billion funds who have had decades of experience, and they still, exemplify these same human behaviors in some way or another. And I think we could all do with an improvement to our routines, how we make decisions, how we approach our days, how we approach our weeks, how we, you know, interpret and understand the world around us. And what I hope to do in this session, this brief session, is just share with you some of the mistakes that I've seen people make at this sort of phase in the market. The market undeniably has been in a bull market for anywhere from, you know, 7 to 10, 11 years, depending on when you start the clock in 2009 or 12 or 13 or whatever. But coming out of that period, we've been in a pretty solid bull market with some minor pullbacks along the way. But overall, the S&P continuing to threaten new highs. A lot of stocks, at or near new highs. Things have pulled back a bit, but overall, rotating higher again this week. And I find when things are well, it was said, don't confuse brains with the bull market. We all feel when the market is doing well, when our portfolios are doing well, that it is because of our incredible skill as investors. And what you have to remember is there's a mix of skill and luck in any sort of investing environment. And so part of it is your incredible skill picking stocks and picking your entry points. It's also the luck of the fact that the market overall is in really good shape. And the problem is when the market rolls over, that's when any problems, any challenges with your routines and with your decision-making becomes magnified and your losses can become a lot more severe than they probably need to be. So let's review how we can hopefully make better decisions through this bull market phase. As a reminder, standard disclaimer, don't do anything with anything I'm about to show you, if you could. My work history, I like to visually sort of represent where I've come from, and I'll just spend a moment on this. This is when I was hiring for a graphic designer when I was at Fidelity. One of our interviewees, instead of giving us a traditional resume, just had a chart of the S&P 500 and had bullet points along the way illustrating their career history. I thought that was just a genius way of demonstrating, number one, just knowing their audience and knowing what they were applying for, but just showing their life experience as an investor through the chart. And so that's what I'll show you here. I started at Bloomberg in New York. I was there from 2000 to 2008. That's where I learned what a stock was. I was joking with a friend of mine in 1999, as the tech bubble was going, I really didn't know anything about stocks. I mean, I'm talking zero. And even after I took the job at Bloomberg, I really couldn't have told you much about what I was going to be doing until I arrived in New York and started learning. And the good thing was they were fantastic about educating liberal arts majors like myself, what the market was and what the economy was, how to calculate bond yields, the role of the Fed and everything in between. And then spent a lot of time, eventually covering North and South America and working with institutional investors, traders, hedge fund managers, portfolio managers, helping them make better decisions using charts. In 2008, I went up to Boston. I ran the technical research team at Fidelity from 2008 to 2016, which was fantastic. It was basically all the equity mutual funds, and we would advise them, about 75 portfolio managers, on what stocks to buy or sell based purely on the charts. That's where I learned a lot about growth investing and trend following, and the idea of leaning into relative winners and leaning away from relative losers, which is still the process that I use today that you'll probably pick up on that very quickly when we start looking at charts. I was the president of the CMT Association, which was called the MTA at the time, from 2010 to 2014, which was a fascinating experience. And if you are more on the institutional side, if you're trying to get there, I would encourage you to explore the CMT exams. It's a professional exam on technical analysis. And even if you don't want to be a professional technical analyst. It's going to make you a better investor, and that's probably worth it just for that. I left Fidelity in 2016, launched my own firm called Sierra Alpha Research in 2017. That's slang. Sierra Alpha is pilot slang for situational awareness. We're going to talk about that, I think, a little bit later in the presentation, but I have a whole aviation theme to my research firm, mainly because I was a student pilot back here in sort of the 2012 to 2016 area. Have not gotten back to it in a couple years, but I learned a ton about the relationship between flying an airplane and the decisions you need to make as a pilot, getting the emotions out of the way versus the decisions we need to make as an investor. On my YouTube channel, which is called Market Misbehavior, I actually just posted, I think today it'll go up, the first of a series called The Pilot's Guide to Investing. We're talking particularly about checklists and flight preparedness. And then finally, I moved to the Seattle area about a year and a half ago, joined Stock Charts full-time as their chief market strategist, which has been fantastic. And I host our daily Closing Bell show on Stock Charts TV. You can go to stockchartstv.com to see all the episodes of that. So, you know, if you look at this chart, I think the other reason to show you this, just to give you a sense of what my background is, it's if you think about when I learned technical analysis, which was really over here, sort of in 2000 to 2002, I would argue I'm still learning about it, you know, 20 years later. But the formative years of me learning why we look at charts and how we look at charts, really, we're in the first couple of years on the left side of the chart. And so if you think about my formative experiences as an investor, it's when the tech bubble was popping. It's when people felt like the markets were incredibly easy. Anyone could do it. And then I saw all of that go away very quickly. I saw sure thing tech companies that were going to go to the moon with, you know, sky high valuations on no earnings and no business plan and see that all unwind. So anytime I see similarities, kind of like we see now, I think with an influx of retail investors with a lot of the same justification for higher prices based on the potential of technology and not the actual business of a technology company. I'm reminded a lot of those earlier. So I don't know if we're going to have another 2002, 2 year pullback, but I'm certainly seeing the frothiness that I was introduced to right when I arrived. And a lot of the ways I use charts, to be honest, are for risk management. And that's because I learned it as a way to, you know, the investors, I think, that survived this time. This was like 9/11. This is a tough time in New York, obviously. It's the people that were able to think about charts and their way to manage risk and not just lock in gains, but minimize the chance of capital loss. And so for me, it's always been an important part of how I think about it. Now, you know, if I would summarize my investment philosophy, it's just fear. Fear drives most decisions of most investors. Now, I was taught when I started that it was fear and greed, fear on the downside and greed on the upside. And that's what drove asset prices. And I studied psychology and music as an undergrad. So the psychology side of me, that made perfect sense. Obviously, the markets would be driven by investor emotions. That I didn't even need to be convinced of that. But fear and greed were interesting. But I think at some point in the last 20 years, that's changed. And it's no longer fear and greed. It's more fear and fear. It's the FOMO. It's fear of missing out on the upside. It's the fear of, you know, you're not going to get into Bitcoin before it goes to the moon or GameStop or whatever the latest thing is that just sort of shoots vertical. On the downside, it's the fear of losing everything. We've now had enough experiences recently of the market just rupturing very quickly. In the last year, we had that. And so I think on either side, investors are motivated by fear. So, you know, if you think about whether charts are still relevant, whether technical analysis is still relevant, given, you know, automation, given computer power, given algorithmic trading, high frequency trading, quantitative strategies, I would argue most of those things are designed to capitalize on investor behavior or misbehavior. They're not trying to, work it out of the system. So I think more than ever, getting a read on investor emotions is going to suit you pretty well. So that's my thesis. Let's get to the 7 bull market mistakes. So again, the market at or near all-time highs. I think it's a perfect time to think about what mistakes people have made, especially as the market would start to top. At some point, this uptrend lightens up. Last week, it felt certainly like that could be the beginning of it. We may be having this initial bounce before the next leg lower. I don't know for sure. What I do know is that stocks more often than not this week seem to be going higher, not lower. And so as the trend is going up, I have to assume that trend is going to continue until proven otherwise. So mistake number one that I've seen is that people develop an investment thesis first and then gather evidence. And if you know behavioral finance or behavioral biases, that's actually called confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is literally, has been studied deeply, and it's where you decide I'm bullish. And then you start looking at evidence, and any evidence that supports your bullish thesis, you sort of gather that, you think highly of that. Any evidence that disagrees with your bullish thesis, you sort of mentally push it away a little bit. And what happens after gathering evidence is all you've done is, just confirm what you had already decided, right? You'd already decided you're bullish. Now you're just kind of coming up with a justification so you can feel better about being bullish. What you want to do, obviously, is flip that. You want to first gather evidence and then develop your thesis, right? Start with a clean slate every day or every week, whenever it is that you're looking at a series of charts. Gather as much as you can and then determine the weight of the evidence. Is the evidence telling me I should be bullish or bearish? This is a chart that I use all the time. It's looking at the cumulative advanced decline lines in four different buckets of stocks. So at the top, it's the NYSE common stock only. So, no closed-end funds or bond funds or anything. It's really just, companies. The S&P advanced decline line, cumulative advanced decline line, the mid-cap advanced decline line, and the small-cap advanced decline line. So sort of four different buckets of stocks. And overall, every day, how many are closing higher and lower? And you take those values and add them up over time, and it turns into these things. In general, the market going higher and these advanced decline lines going higher is very constructive. So what you don't want to do is decide, all right, I think the markets are topping out and now I need to find some charts to help me justify why I should be bearish right now. And then find that these lines have maybe broken their 50-day moving average and say, okay, good. That's one thing I can put on the list of things that might be bearish. And at the end, you've got enough evidence in your bearish list. You can then feel better about the fact that you're bearish. What you want to do is look at this with a clean slate. So what I do every Friday is I very subjectively color code these orange for neutral, green for bullish, red for bearish. And I look at the lines and I don't think about how I'm positioned or what I'm telling clients or anything like that. I just look at the lines. I look at the charts and say, overall, are these in uptrends or downtrends? And last Friday, when I changed these last, I saw this was into Friday's close. You had the two of these break down through their 50-day moving average. And I said, all right, that could be the beginning of them not going higher anymore. I'm going to color code those orange. These two are remaining above their 50. Today, they're all remaining above their previous swing lows from mid-December. So overall, I think those are still fairly constructive until they break their 50-day. And so as of Friday, I color-coded them sort of mixed, half neutral, half bullish. I feel pretty comfortable with that being the assessment. Now, since then, they've bounced the last couple of days, obviously with some higher prices this week with the S&P coming off its 50-day moving average, having not broken it. So overall, that's still fine. I feel pretty good about, sort of half bullish and half neutral. But what you have to remember is that it's all based on the evidence. I always talk about the weight of the evidence, or one of my mentors years ago talked about, painting a mosaic with all the evidence. You gather as much as you can, then you look at it in a big pile and say, overall, what is the, summarization? How would I summarize this pile of stuff into an investment thesis? Paul Montgomery, who's someone you may or may not know, he wrote a research report for years and years called, I should remember this, Universal Economics, I want to say. It's been a while, but he's unfortunately no longer with us, but one of his great quotes was, the most bullish thing the market can do is go up. Because it's so funny, we talk all about headwinds and tailwinds and the coronavirus, economic shutdowns, who's president, what their policies might be, the dollar, gold, all these things, and they're all just things. They're all potential headwinds and tailwinds. At the end of the day, the market will tell you what the market's doing. And if you want to look for bullish evidence, look for a market going higher. That's it. So I have a market trend model that I've followed for years, and it basically it's all based on weekly data, and there's a long-term component, medium-term component, short-term component. They're all based on exponential moving averages on the weekly chart. And to summarize, all of them at this moment are bullish. On last Friday, the short-term signal turned negative. And again, I just update these every Friday at the close. So if the week would end today, you might have a bit of a change. But as of last Friday, the short-term one had turned bearish, the medium-term bullish, the long-term indicator bullish. So until proven otherwise, I have to assume that this uptrend is in place. And for me, the way you know that a trend is no longer in place is you start to break down through support. You start to show patterns of distribution, weakening breadth. But the main thing is price stops going higher, stops making higher highs and higher lows, and starts making lower lows and lower highs. So we had an outside week or a bearish engulfing pattern on the weekly chart of the S&P last week. Is that a concern? Absolutely. I think you've had breadth conditions that have got lightened up a little bit. Absolutely. You've had sentiment indicators that were euphoric a couple weeks ago. that's kind of negative as well. But until the price stops going up, the trend is positive, as Paul Montgomery reminded us. So gather your evidence first and then develop your investment thesis. That's mistake number one and how to correct it. Mistake number two is waiting too long to develop an exit strategy. You know, I often, you know, with my show called The Final Bar, which is on Stock Charts TV after the close every day, we have a Q&A segment called The Mailbag twice a week. And a lot of my questions will relate to a stock that's down and people ask, well, what should they do now? And my first comment back to everyone is you should figure out what you're going to do before it starts to come down. You know, when the thing's coming down is not when you want to start to think about your exit strategy. And I relate it back to, you know, learning to fly a Cessna 172R. You know, the time when you figured out what your game plan was in case of emergency, what airport you'd land at, do you have enough altitude, do you have enough fuel? Those are things you figured out when everything was great. When you're flying straight and level, there are no issues. That's when you're looking around and thinking, okay, if something would happen right now, there's an airport, I have enough altitude, what's the frequency? Okay. And you're just ready. And then when something happens, you don't have to think about what do I do now? You have a checklist, you have a series of steps that you follow in case of emergency. And as an investor, you need to do the same thing. When stocks you own are making new highs, I would argue that's the time to be thinking about when you take profits. What would that chart start to look like where you would say, okay, this is no longer deserves a place in my portfolio. It's no longer is showing the signs of optimism or of an uptrend. And that's when you want to start making those calls. So right now, when hopefully a lot of the stocks you own are going up or at or near new highs, that's when I would be looking through your holdings and draw lines on the chart, a line that you're going to stick to that says, no matter what, if we break this level, I'm out. Even if it's a trailing stop, average true range, percent stop, whatever it is, something that you follow and that you just use as a stop no matter what. That's going to prevent a climactic loss in your portfolio. Ned Davis at a dinner years ago, who's a fantastic researcher and market commentator for years, said all large losses begin as small losses. So keep your losses while they're still small and don't hold on to them while they get ruptured. So here's a chart of Disney. This is from 2019, really going into the first quarter of 2020 when Disney, along with many stocks, obviously broke down. So Disney went from 150 at the top down to 80. It almost halved in price over a four-month period. And my question is, you know, if your stock is making new highs here in November, overall, the chart is looking pretty good. You'd have to feel pretty good about owning Disney in terms of its performance. You know, somewhere between mid-November and mid-March, a lot of signals should have told you probably that Disney is no longer a great chart. It started with leading indicators like a bearish divergence, right? The stock making new highs into late November, the momentum making lower highs. That's a bearish divergence. Arguably, we've seen that divergence on charts like Tesla recently, right? Which is one of the reasons why I'm sort of the early warning signals have triggered, but not the confirmation signals yet of a price breakdown. The relative strength went from going higher to going lower. The price broke down through the 50-day and the 200-day moving average. Price broke down through its recent lows. So it was making lower lows and lower highs. It broke down through major support here in October. So at this point, like, I don't know from a technical perspective how you could justify owning this if you're, you know, if you're a trend follower and you're trying to own stocks that are working. So the problem is a lot of investors held stocks like Disney as they go down to 80 and have all sorts of reasons why you justify owning it. One of the things we might call that is endowment bias, or the endowment effect, which is things you own, you have an emotional attachment to them and it causes you to treat them differently than if it's something you don't own. And one of the money managers at Fidelity used to say, you know, treat stocks not as things you own, but as things you rent, and think of them as a rental agreement that you can cancel at any time if it no longer is the right place for you to be. So if you'd own Disney today, and this is as of yesterday's close, I didn't look at what it was doing so far this morning, but, you know, overall, Disney is in a much better place. There's that March low, and you can see overall, it had a period of sort of market performance, sort of a sideways performer, kind of keeping pace with the market, but it really accelerated in the fourth quarter. And this is when things like Disney Plus and everything really start to recognize the transition of Disney from, you know, relying on theme parks to relying on content and having an app that my family, at least, we've been unable to not watch Disney, I think, for most evenings around the Keller household. And it shows you in price how that has been recognized. So overall, I would argue now is the time to be looking at the chart of Disney. It bounced back to its 50-day and now is rotating back higher. You know, it arguably could break to new highs. And overall, I think until proven otherwise, a chart like this, I'm assuming it's going to go higher. You've had some warnings, right? You've had another bearish divergence of a higher high going into year end and a lower peak in momentum. That might be one concern. The relative strength, while, you know, bouncing a bit this week, overall has not been great in the new year, right? A lot of the outperformance, all the outperformance really came in through the end of December. Since then, again, it's been sort of a market underperformer. So, you know, at what level? Is it a break to new lows below 160? Is it a confirmed break below the 50-day? Is it a Fibonacci level that you would draw that would tell you? Is it a percent off of the high or something? I would be thinking about those things now while Disney overall is still in a decent shape, not later when it's down at 120 and then you scratch your head and wonder whether you should start reconsidering your position. So do not wait too long to develop an exit strategy, especially on positions that are working pretty well. My third bull market mistake I see people make is an over-reliance on analogs. And what an analog means for me is anytime you hear someone say, this looks a lot like blank, and you know, this looks a lot like 2009 or 2001 or 1983 or whatever relationship, or they show you a chart that says, here's two other times when this happened, here's what happened afterwards. And so that's why it's obviously going to happen the same way. I've seen, and I think one of the least effective things you could probably do is take a chart of a historical period and overlay the current chart and assume with any sort of statistical significance that the current pattern is going to match the previous pattern. If you showed a statistician what some of us do with charts, they would say that is literally the least effective thing you could possibly do, because you're taking one observation and comparing it to a second and assuming that they're going to be identical, which is not a realistic assumption by any stretch. So, you know, when you're looking at a chart of the S&P going back to, you know, for the last 20 years or so, you know, I often think about, you know, where are we at right now versus some of these previous peaks. So, you know, very quickly, you can see just this pattern of the steep sell-off, this essentially V bottom, and then the acceleration to new highs. To me, the only other period that this looks like is sort of that 2009 to 2010 period, where you see, you know, the market going lower, the market turning higher, and going from there. Having said that, I think an over-reliance on an analog would say, so clearly we're right here, and that means we need to pull back in January. We rally into a high in April. We make a new low in June, and then we make a new high in end of the year. Done. That's all I need to know. You know, you can't assume that this year is going to be like any other particular year. So is there any purpose to looking at those historical comparisons? Absolutely. And I think one thing I learned from working with money managers, you know, for years was the value of talking about how things relate to previous times. So having the analog, you know, looking at where we're at right now with an acceleration out of a deep oversold condition, accelerating to new highs with breadth really participating. This is the percent of stocks above their 200-day moving average. And, you know, at the end of March or mid-March of last year, you were in single digits. I think it was like 4 or 5% of the S&P remaining above their 200-day. Pretty much everything else was below it. The only other times you've been that low are in late 2008, leading up to the 2009 low, and in mid-2002, you know, just before the October 2002 low, which was the bottom of that phase before the acceleration higher to 2007. So the only other times breadth conditions using this indicator look similar are in two other times, which were basically early on in an extended bull market phase, right? I mean, long-term, this seems to be a fairly constructive pattern. So assuming that the market's obviously going to do nothing but go higher because that's what happened these other two times, I think is a miss. I think that's an over-reliance on the analog. Thinking about what are the conditions right now versus what they were in mid to late 2009 and mid to late 2003. You know, what were the conditions that allowed stocks to rotate from being very bombed out to all of a sudden very positive? What caused the market to go so much higher, so much more quickly? And what were the conditions in the subsequent years that allowed a sustainable market? And what do we see now in terms of the dollar, in terms of commodities, in terms of inflation, in terms of the role of the Fed? You know, those are the sorts of conversation. And that's what I found working with money managers. It's all about the charts being the starting point of a really good conversation about how now relates to other historical periods and what we can draw, what conclusions we can draw about, you know, scenarios we might see and the probability of different outcomes. Assuming that tomorrow is going to be anything like a previous day based purely on what happened one or two other times is an over-reliance. So don't over-rely on analogs, but use them as a way to have a deeper discussion and challenge your thesis and what you might expect going forward. The fourth bull market mistake that I see people make is thinking in terms of certainties and not probabilities. You know, I'm often asked, and I do a lot of financial media in terms of my own shows, but I get interviewed a lot. And people love to ask, are you bullish or bearish on blank? You know, give me a price target. And you are encouraged in a 2 to 3 minute segment or even a 30 second soundbite to be absolutely certain and to imply this certainty and this incredible foresight of exactly what's going to happen. Now, in reality, anyone actually investing knows that it's never certain. There is no sure thing. There is no holy grail. There is no absolute certainty that anything's going to happen. We could guess at what Bitcoin is going to be. We can guess whether Bitcoin is going to be, you know, $100,000 or more to the US dollar. Or $100,000 plus relative to the US dollar. We could guess that Bitcoin's going to go back below 10,000. We don't know for certain which of those, if either, is actually going to happen, right? It's all based on probabilistic outcomes. And, you know, one of the things I've learned over my career, the investors that I've worked with that I really respect and had long-term outperforms, really able to perform well over the long term, were the ones that thought of the markets and thought of the future in terms of potential future paths. Here's what I think is most likely to happen. Here are the other things which could happen. And you think about all those scenarios. Even as an analyst team, when I ran a team of technical analysts, someone always had to play devil's advocate. So if we found, you know, we would often have bull bear debates on anything, on a particular stock and whatever. And if we brought up the chart of Apple and everyone was bullish, someone would have to take the bearish side of it and argue the bearish point and just see what would that look like? What would happen? How would that actually play out? What would that feel like? How would that appear? What would that mean to other things we're looking at? What would that mean to the technology sector? How would that relate to the market as a whole? And we would think about all those scenarios. And then if and when Apple actually went down, it wasn't a surprise. And it's not like we didn't know what we should do in that scenario because we'd always thought about it, right? I think as investors, and especially I'm seeing that more recently, when people get into a stock like GameStop when it's going vertical, it's because of the chase of something awesome. It's a lottery ticket that could go to the moon. And that's what you're thinking about. You're not thinking of it in risk reward terms and thinking, how much has GameStop appreciated so far? What does that mean relative to, you know, whatever is reasonable? And how should I think about the potential of downside risk? What happens if it loses 50% tomorrow? Am I still going to want to hold it or not? And if you think about those sort of things ahead of time, then you're not making a reaction based on emotion. And that's what this really gets ahead of. When you think in certainties and your certain outcome doesn't happen, when you think no matter what, the market's going to go higher in February of 2020, and then the market rolls over and starts breaking support, you're then caught off guard and then you panic. And then you make decisions from a position of emotional weakness, not a position of rational interpretation of the evidence. If you've already thought, all right, I like how things are going, I like my positioning, but if XYZ happens, I'm going to exit these positions. If the market breaks this, I'm going to go to cash. And you just think about that ahead of time. Then when that happens, it's not an emotional reaction to it. You just make the decision based on the checklist. And, you know, for me, and I mentioned checklists, again, this comes back to learning to fly an airplane. And one of the least comfortable moments for me flying an airplane was simulated emergencies. And the first couple times they did it, the very first time I remember it, you're flying at like 4,000 feet and the instructor just leans over and pulls out the throttle all the way, just kills the engine. And the plane immediately just, you know, boom, everything. It's like you're falling. It's like you're going over the top of a roller coaster and you shoot down. He says, all right, you're calmly says this as the plane's going down. All right, you just lost your engine. What do you do? And I'll tell you what you do. You completely freak out. I still, just as I'm describing it, my palms are just starting to sweat a little bit. You feel your heart beating. Your heart goes in your throat. You have this visceral physical reaction to the fact that the plane is not flying anymore. And you scramble, like as the thing's going lower, I'm scrambling for this piece of paper, this laminated form that has my checklist for engine cutouts. And I'm trying to like do the things. I'm shaking a little bit. And, you know, eventually kind of steps in. He helps me do it. Yep, you do this. And you learn, you know, it's possible to recover very easily from that scenario. And there are steps you follow to make sure you land the plane safely if you need to. Months later, he would do that same simulation. He pulls out the throttle and it wasn't even a thing. I'm like, I'm half yawning as I'm like doing the things like a figure seven on the dashboard. You go, you check it. That usually fixes things. If not, you open the door a little bit, you find a place to land, you circle around it, and you follow the checklist that you know. And in the end, you can actually handle that scenario fairly safely. And what happened at the end was I no longer was having a deep emotional reaction to it. It was just factual. It was, all right, the engine's not working. What do I need to do to make sure the plane can fly as well as it can and give me enough time to communicate and fly the plane and figure out where to land? So as an investor, that's the same mentality you want to do. You know, you can probably think if you own a big position, and arguably this is probably a position that's too big if you panic like that physically about it, but a stock you own has done well, a position has done great, and all of a sudden it just turns on you. It just goes the opposite direction. You lose 8-10% in one day. And you, a lot of time, you bring up the monitor, you see the red, and you have those same physical reactions that you would have if your plane stalls in midair. And so what you learn is obviously the way to handle it, not from an emotional perspective, but from a factual evidence-based perspective. Okay, this position is now no longer as positive. All right, has it done enough to convince me that I need to rotate lower? What are the steps that I want to analyze? What pieces pieces of information on the chart do I want to list out and characterize to determine whether or not I still deserve, or this stock still deserves to be in my portfolio? And if it still does, then fine. You don't worry about it. It's just, all right, it still deserves to be in there. I'll wait until this happens. Or you decide, all right, that's it. I've seen enough and I'm done, and you move on to something else. So when Bitcoin had just broken above 14,000 and gotten to 18,000, which seems like light years ago, and it really wasn't. It was less than 4 or 5 months ago when this happens. You know, and since then it went, essentially vertical, went all the way to 42,000. There was no guarantee that it was going to go to much higher. I actually published something, published a video talking about Bitcoin going to 37,000. It wasn't here. It was when it retested, when it was getting near to 20,000 and sort of testing that all-time high. And I said, all right, if we break that, we actually could get to 37,000, which was laughably high at the time. Of course, since then, that's way in the rearview mirror because we got all the way up to 42,000. I don't think you can think of anything in terms of certainties, especially now. One thing I've learned about life in general over the last year is nothing is certain, nothing is definite. Everything's fluid in life, including life itself. So, what's happened from Bitcoin from that September pullback level around 10,000 to reaching an all-time high around 42,000? If you look, it's hit a pretty clear support level, a Fibonacci level, 38.2% that it's retraced from September to January. It bounced off that a number of times, also bounced off the 50-day moving average. It's since resolved higher. At this point, I see Bitcoin returning to 42,000 and continuing on until proven otherwise. A break of the 50-day, a break of 30,000, which would be that Fibonacci support, would be what I would need to see to think of Bitcoin being materially lower from here. Until then, it certainly feels like it's flat to positive overall. So that is, that is my most likely outcome. I'm going to assume my probabilistic path for Bitcoin is higher, but I could see a scenario where it goes lower. I could see where it tests support and fails, where it fails through the 50 and it breaks 30,000. And what I've already said is if it breaks 30,000, the downside target's 22,000. That would be the swing low from December. That would be a 61.8% retracement. That would be a severe pullback relative to where it's been. And I think that's where you reevaluate the potential for further downside or its ability to hold support and go higher. So that's a scenario I've already thought about. And I've thought about what the chart would look like and what I would need to see to turn more negative on Bitcoin. And that's how you want to think about it. Not in terms of certainties. I know Bitcoin's going higher, but in terms of probabilities. I think this is the most likely scenario, but here's some alternate scenarios, and here's what it would mean for me as an investor. The fifth option, or the fifth bull market mistake, is forgetting your time frame. There's a thing called myopic loss aversion, which is in the behavioral sort of finance toolkit. And if you've heard of either any of those, loss aversion is probably something you can come up with. Basically, we are averse to losing, right? And in general, psychological tests and interviews and other things have shown that we hate to lose a lot more than we like to win. Losing hurts a lot more than winning. It feels good. We remember our losses. We dwell on them. We stew on them. We feel them very deeply. And wins are good, but we don't spend as much time enjoying our wins as we do struggling with our losses. So that's loss aversion. We don't like when things go against us. Myopia, or the myopic part, is short-termism. Basically, faced with loss, we get way too short-term. So when everything's great and then the stock goes down one day, you panic and feel like you need to sell everything. Even though you probably don't need to sell anything based on the technical inputs, right? Overall, that might be you take some of your position off. You take 50% of it off, 25% of it off. You begin to scale out of a position. You take some profits, right? You think of it more reasonably given the short-term movement should be a short-term reaction. Maybe it just tells you, all right, maybe it's not going higher anymore. Here are the support levels I want to pay attention to. But what we don't want to do if you're a long-term investor is really ever make a decision on a chart like this, which is a 5-minute chart of the S&P. And anytime I see someone like a financial advisor asking me about a chart like this, my first answer is, why exactly are you looking at this chart? And let's be very careful about what conclusions you are drawing from this. If you're just trying to understand the short-term dynamics and see how they relate to the big picture and how you're positioned, okay, I can deal with that. If you're making any investment decisions based on this sort of time frame, I would argue you're trying to use a chart that is not in line with your investment horizon. So, what I always tell people is remember when something has pulled back, as a long-term investor, that actually might be a very constructive pattern. And the perfect chart of that is Plug Power. At Stock Charts, we have what's called the Scooter Rankings, the Stock Charts Technical Ranking. And we have different universes, large cap, mid cap, small cap, ETFs, industries. It's a really good way of taking a big universe of stuff, of things, of tickers, and ordering them from strongest to weakness. And it has some different components. Our website explains that in more detail if you want to learn about it. But the number one, the top ranked stock in our mid cap universe for months and months has been Plug Power, which is a hydrogen name. It's in a group group called Renewable Energy Equipment with a lot of the solar stocks and some other things. But if you look, this chart really from, you know, June of 2020 has just been in this nice consistent uptrend, higher highs, higher lows. It's pulled back to its 50-day moving average a number of times. Every time it's result higher. So, you know, if you're thinking too short term and you see the stock pulling back in October, it would be very easy to get shaken out of a long position as a long-term investor, because you see the weakness, you see daily, bet getting smaller, you see the returns going down, you see the red on the screen, and all of a sudden you think, okay, I've had enough, I need to get out. But what you want to do is look at the right, at the appropriate picture. Looking at a daily chart, just with the 50-day moving average, and look at the higher highs and higher lows, the trend is positive. Until you break down through the most recent low, the trend is positive. The lows keep getting higher, the trend is up. And so it'll keep you from getting out of something way too early. And you know, I found working with professional investors as well as individuals, I think there are four things you can do very poorly as a decision maker. You can buy too early, you can buy too late, you can sell too early, you can sell too late. Pretty much all of your mistakes are in one of those categories. And there are a lot of reasons why you do it, but that's how it comes into. And I think selling too early, one of the main reasons that happens is because not having a proper time frame. Make sure if you're a long-term investor, you're using a long-term chart to make sure that it's in proper context. I don't have a problem with you looking at short-term analysis, short-term fluctuations, because it helps you get a sense of what the environment is and how investors are acting in the short term, but make sure long-term decisions are made using long-term data. We're almost done. The sixth one is getting married to a negative. This is the sixth mistake I see people make. And you know, you think of something like stocks and gold have a particular relationship. Gold is a safe haven, which means when stocks are going higher, gold's probably going lower. On the opposite, when stocks are struggling, gold is going to go higher because it's a safe haven, and that's where people are going to be. The reality is, of course, not exactly that. There are plenty of times when stocks go lower. For example, the fourth quarter of 2018, stocks really came off, made a new swing low there in December of 2018. You can see gold appreciated. So if you're looking for an example of gold as a safe haven, I would say the fourth quarter of 2008 is a perfect example of that. But what does that mean for late 2019 or early 2020? Stocks were going higher, gold was going higher. So is it a safe haven at that point when it's kind of going up with stocks? You can actually show this statistically. So at the bottom, I'm showing the rolling 20-day correlation of the S&P 500 and gold. I ask you, you know, is it showing a strong negative correlation, which is what it would imply if they have an inverse relationship? Stocks go higher, gold goes down. If that's the case, this line would be very low, around, you know, 0.8 to negative 1, which would be a perfect inverse correlation. But it's not, you know, I would argue it kind of rotates around the zero level, which is literally no relationship, no consistent relationship. There are stretches when they are positively correlated, and there are stretches when they're negatively correlated. Bob Proctor, who's, you know, obviously worked with Frost and others and built on Ralph Elliott's work to promote Elliott Wave, and has done a fantastic job explaining the wave-like nature of markets. I'm not a big Elliott Wave guy, but I love how he talks about the behavior of investors and how the waves quantify or really characterize the investor behavior. That part I'm 100% on board with. And what Bob would tell you is that if you are ever making a one-on-one relationship, you know, saying stocks versus gold or stocks versus interest rates, the dollar versus small caps, you're making a huge assumption that there is a consistent, specific relationship and that that relationship happens in a vacuum. And what I will tell you is with almost nothing in the markets, is there a perfect consistent relationship, and nothing happens in a vacuum. The markets are not a simple mechanism of one, two variables, and you're just looking at how the two of them fluctuate. There are literally an unlimited number of things. So when you're looking at stocks versus gold, you have to also remember there are other forces at play. There's the Fed, there's investor sentiment, there is the coronavirus, there are economic challenges, there are geopolitical issues, there are election challenges, all of those things net out into what the market actually does. So, what I often tell people is if you ever find, as you're describing your investment thesis or your investment process, if you use the word should, that is a bad thing. There are very few times when you use the word should as an investor, and that's a good idea. And I once said should is a four-letter word for investors. When you say should, you're implying that something should happen because of some relationship. You know, because stocks are sort of going higher, gold should be going down. But it doesn't matter. Gold can go up for much longer than you think. And later, the narrative that actually played out, the reason why gold went higher or went lower, usually makes a ton of sense. It's crystal clear in the rearview mirror. But looking forward, it's actually very hard to figure out how one relationship is going to impact asset prices for the foreseeable future. And so I think if you ever hear yourself yourself saying, all right, well, this has happened, interest rates are going higher, which means this should happen. Financial sector should be doing better. Yeah, I mean, I get the argument, but I would not think of it that way. I would be looking at the chart of the 10-year. I would be looking at the chart of the KBE, the KRE, banks, real estate, regional banks, and look at how they're actually performing. The chart will tell you whether or not it's a good time to own financial stocks. It's not what should happen based on the shape of the yield curve. You can make assumptions and you can define that relationship. You can maybe develop a probabilistic outcome. This could happen. Could is much better. I would be okay with that. So use could instead of should, and never use will, because nothing is absolutely certain, as we saw from one of the earlier bull market mistakes. The seventh one, the last one, is overestimating your performance and process. As I mentioned earlier, maybe in the introduction, you know, when the market is doing well in a bull market phase, we love to confuse a bull market and its impact on our portfolio with our skill as investors. We tend to think that we are a rock star stock picker when the stocks that we pick have gone higher and when our portfolio is growing. And don't get me wrong, I'd prefer that to the alternative any day. But you can't confuse the market going higher with your skill. There is some skill, hopefully, and most likely involved, right? If you've been able to lean into winners and lean away from things, and you've managed your portfolio, use good money management skills, there's a skill involved there. And there are things you could do, less ideally, that would hurt your returns. But overall, the fact that the market's going higher, a rising tide lifts all boats, it's been said, overall, it's easy to feel very good about our portfolio and attribute that to our skill as investors. When the markets go down, it's funny how we tend to not blame our poor skill as investors. We tend to blame bad luck. We say the market went against us. We talk about, how unlucky it was. It was just a bad day. It was just a bad week, a bad month. And we easily want to shrug that off and go to the forward. So when we're doing well, it's because of our incredible skill. When it's going poorly, it's our luck. And in reality, it's probably both. It's a mix of both in both cases, right? When the market's going well, hopefully part of that in your ability to outperform is based on your skill as an investor, but there's also a dose of luck in there, right? You can't force a company to report certain earnings or force a stock higher. It's called the illusion of control, and it's not a thing. It's not true. Now, you can't literally will your stocks to go higher. It happens, right? On the downside, again, it's not all bad luck. It could be, there are things that you could do better. One of my mentors always, after a tough period as an investor, would say, what did you learn and what are you going to do differently? And that's something I would encourage you to think about after any tough stretch. Whether it's just a tough trading day, a tough quarter, a tough month, a tough year, look back and see what you can learn from those experiences. That's how you grow as an investor, become a better trader over time. So a funny thing happens, actually, and it's actually called hindsight bias. And when something happens, the further it gets in the rearview mirror, the more we actually optimize our own recollection of our performance. And I'll show you what I mean. This is a chart of Home Depot, sort of rallied in, made a new high in February, and it bottomed out, just about a couple days before the market eventually hit its lowest low on March 23rd. And then from there, obviously, Home Depot and most stocks appreciated pretty well from the point that I took this stock, but took this screenshot. But this is really the rupturing of a stock making new highs. Disney, many others made a new high in February, and then they all just got crushed at the end of the end of the first quarter. So what might have actually happened? Let's just walk through maybe a potential scenario. It's making new highs. There's no reason why you want to sell it. You're fine. It didn't even make a bearish divergence in this case. It actually kept going higher. Feels good. It breaks down to its 200-day moving average. It bounces higher. And so you're thinking, okay, whew, we saved. We found support at, 210, which was the low from there. We bounced off the 200-day. I could see us returning to new highs. Perfect. I'm going to hold it. Then we bounce again off 210, and then we start making new lows. And here's where it starts really getting hairy. And every day, it feels like we're going down another 15, 20 points. So somewhere along this way, maybe you cut some of it when it broke the 200-day. Let's assume we're really good as a trend follower. And when it finally breaks down through the 200-day, closes below it a couple times, you cut your losses. So you cut them there. Then you don't buy on March 18th on the actual low, because you're pretty much assuming this is going to go to zero because it keeps going down every day. Then it chops around a little bit and then it jumps higher. Maybe you don't believe that exactly, but a couple days later, you say, okay, I'm going to get back in. And at 195, you get in there. Here's what your brain will actually do the further February and March of 2020 get behind you in your history. The way you sold it actually moves back and back until eventually you literally have convinced yourself that you knew it was going to top out at the top. And you didn't buy it or decide to buy it here at 185. You really sort of knew when it was bombed out at 145 that was probably near the end. And you finally kind of did it there. But in your brain, you saw a lot clearer evidence and it becomes more and more optimized. So literally our performance gets better and better the further rickets in our rearview mirror. So how do you fight that is basically to keep a really good trading journal. Anytime you make any decision, write it down somewhere. And I encourage new investors, write it on a piece of paper and write down, here's a decision I made and why it was at this level. And this is what I was looking at. I always, you know, if a chart analyst, which, you know, hopefully you're using charts. And what I do on stock charts is literally put comments right on the chart with a date. And I say, here's what I did and here's why. And so there's no denying months later what caused me to buy or sell at a certain point. And it's really clear when it was a bad decision or when it was a good decision, because I can see exactly on the chart what fueled that decision and what I did afterwards. So don't confuse brains with a bull market. You know, keep a good track record of your decisions, especially now. And if and when things roll over, which I'm going to assume at some point they do for stocks overall, that's how you sort of manage it and make sure that you have a good way of learning from some of your poor decisions. So now I've given you those seven bull market mistakes, how to avoid them. And now I will reverse these into more of a positive phrasing to give you what I would call my bull market playbook. These are the seven things I hope you do during a bull market phase, which arguably we are still in. And now's the time to be thinking about these things. So number one, gather evidence first and then develop a thesis, right? It's all about, I would argue, the weight of the evidence that you can look at. So be a good investor, be a well-rounded investor, gather what you can, and then look at the weight of the evidence and determine what your investment thesis should be. Don't start with a thesis and then try to gather evidence. That'll kill your independent ability to consume information. Number two, plan for emergencies when things are good. Don't wait for things you own to roll over to determine what your exit strategy is going to be. As you're flying straight and level, as your portfolio is doing well, the market's going fine, that's when you want to think about some emergency scenarios and what decisions you're going to make and when. Number three, view analogs as descriptive and not prescriptive. I have no problem with looking at where we're at now and comparing it to 2010. I actually think that's a decent comparison of any to think about the market coming off a really bombed out level and then having more of a choppy year. But at the end of the day, that for me does not prescribe this is what is going to happen and that's why I need to own these stocks. It's more descriptive. It gives me a starting point to think about how the outcomes this year relate to what we might have seen in other years and make decisions that way. Number four, think in terms of probabilities and never certainties, right? Nothing is certain in life or in the markets. Absolutely in the markets. When quoted in financial media, they insist that you describe things as an expert and describe it in very certain terms. I would argue that's not how you can invest very well. You can't think of things in certainties. You think of things in probabilities and you think about alternative scenarios and what you would do in those cases. Number five, remember your time frame. If you're a short-term investor, focus on short-term price dynamics. If you're a long-term investor, focus on long-term trends. I don't have a problem with you looking at the other timeframes. And guys like Brian Shannon, who wrote a book on multiple timeframe analysis, make a very decent case. And I think a very thoughtful case about why you would want to look at other timeframes. And I think that's actually very good, but make sure your decisions are coming from the right information. Number six, focus on the charts and not the narrative. There's a thing called narrative bias where we get caught up in a story and how something's going to play out. And then we think, basically think that that's reality. Focus on the charts, not the narrative of what could happen, what should happen, how two things might be related. Focus on the charts themselves. Think less about what gold should do because of what the stock market is doing or what the dollar is doing. Look at the chart of gold and make your decisions based on what the chart itself is doing. Coincidentally, breaking down today and going from a consolidation phase, potentially to a new distribution phase, if you look at the GLD. And then finally, number seven, use a journal. Learn from your wins and losses. I think one of the worst, I always coach investors on being more mindful investors. And one of the things I learned is that if you keep a journal of your wins and your losses, you can learn from both of those. The best thing you can do as an investor, have a regular time where you look back at some of your decisions that did not go well and see what you can do to improve that process. That was my presentation. If you are interested in any of this in terms of how you think about how you think as an investor, I'd encourage you to go to my website, marketmisbehavior.com. I have a free behavioral investing course. It's a 5-week course, which will send you an email every week and just challenge you to revisit a little bit of your investment process every week. Hopefully it helps you helps nudge you in that right direction. On the Stock Charts TV, if you go to stockchartstv.com, I host the Closing Bell show called The Final Bar. It runs every weekday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Have a lot of great guests on there to sort of pick their brain. And if you can read the tickers on this last slide, you get my final message, which is thank you. I appreciate it, David and Anka, for including me. I hope this has been helpful for all of you. If you have questions, I'd be open to them now, or my email's been on the screen the whole presentation. You're welcome to email me as well.